On March 15th, 44 BC, several members of the Roman Senate joined in the assassination of Julius Caesar. The aftermath of that deed produced more than a decade of conflict as various individuals struggled to gain the power that Julius Caesar left behind. Sometime before his death, in his will that was read after his death, the slain emperor named his great nephew Octavius as his adopted son and heir and successor. Octavius, still a young man at that time, in his 20s, joined Mark Antony in the first phase of the conflict. And in that phase, Octavius and Antony joined together to defeat the leaders of the conspiracy against Julius Caesar, principally the men who led the conspiracy, Brutus and Cassius. Eventually, an uneasy peace between Octavius and Mark Antony dissolved into more conflict, because Mark Antony and Cleopatra, the Queen of Egypt, wanted to assert control over the whole world. At the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, Octavius defeated Antony, who, along with his wife, committed suicide in the aftermath. And that left Octavius in the position of to consolidate his power over the various factions of the Roman Republic and to become, though he never used the title of himself, the first emperor of the Romans. He preferred to be known as the first citizen of the Romans. Some date the beginning of his imperial administration from 29 BC, others dated from 27 BC. He continued to occupy the imperial throne until his death in AD 14 at the age of 75. The administration of the one who took the title of Caesar and Augustus, and in verse 1 of chapter 2, you find the only reference in the Bible to this man by his formal title. The administration of this one was one of the world's golden ages. While the emperor's armies continued to wage wars of conquest on the empire's borders, the areas under the emperor's control enjoyed a period of peace and prosperity that lasted in some places for 200 years. As the years passed and the demands on the imperial resources escalated, the emperor determined to enumerate all of the people in his dominions. So he issued a decree. We read of the decree here in Luke chapter 2. He issued a decree that all the people in the world, meaning the world over which he ruled, should return to their ancestral homes to register themselves. And the translators of the King James Version understood what the purpose of the census was. It was to be sure that everybody was paying taxes to the empire. The truth of the Roman Empire was that as time went by, it required larger and larger revenues to finance its burgeoning operations, to keep its armies in the field. The great Caesar approached the issue with the practical mind of a problem solver, and in that he was a typical Roman. Of the long-standing prophecies concerning the birth of Jesus Christ, he had little, if any, knowledge, and he cared nothing about such things. His business was government. His only motivation was to preserve his position of authority and his ability to carry out his purposes. Unwittingly, however, the great Caesar, and you hear echoes of that title in the Tsars of Russia and in the Kaiser of Germany early in the 20th century, the great Caesar became an instrument in the hands of God. It was an irony, really, that the administrative fiat of one of history's most powerful and influential rulers was the tool to accomplish the prophecies concerning the birth of Christ. There were two purposes operating in those days. They were divergent. One was the purpose of the emperor. The other was the purpose of God. But in the decree of Caesar Augustus, of which we read here, the purpose of the human ruler, Caesar Augustus, submerged in the long-standing purpose of God, the one who placed the great Caesar on his throne. Augustus never knew. That's why I call it an irony. He never knew what was really behind the decree he issued. He thought he did. But he died a decade before the public ministry of Jesus of Nazareth came to the attention of any Roman officials. But as happens with regularity, Caesar's focus on his responsibilities as the administrator of this vast empire and his focus on what he wanted produced the circumstances that surrounded the birth of Jesus. It's interesting to keep this reality in mind in our age, when pathetic political figures assume that they are in control of events. We find the comforting theme that God is the one who rules over all. The opening verses of one of the Bible's most famous chapters are a study in the conflict that is government versus God. Government versus God. When we consider the history of the world, especially the developments of the last century or so, we find that governments have determined to accomplish what they want many times regardless of truth. The members of the political class in whatever generation use their imagined power in which they boast themselves to spread falsehoods that are blatant contradictions of the facts. They comfort themselves that they have the authority and see no problem in using it. Still, those who know God and who therefore know the truth, understand that the decrees of the political class have validity only so far as they advance the accomplishment of the purposes of God. The people of God then learn not to take the posturings of political figures so seriously. They know God. And they know that God will achieve his decrees whatever the world's governments express in their decrees. It is what happened in the world of Caesar Augustus. So today, and for the next two Lord's days, we're going to take an in-depth look at this famous passage to understand how God's purpose overrode any intention of the Roman government. When you recognize what God was doing, when you see it, then you can take the pronouncements of foolish people today with the understanding that not what they want, not what they determine, but what God has decreed shall come to pass. These three verses lay before us three clear ideas that I want to lay before you today, and we're going to take more time on the first of these ideas. First, history's crucial moment. History's crucial moment. We are living near the end of 2019. And the fact that we are living near the end of 2019 is the demonstration that Jesus Christ was born at the time of which we read in this passage. The year in which we live is Anno Domini, the Latin phrase that means the year of the Lord. It is the year of the Lord, 2019, or if you prefer, 2019. That date references the very time of which we read in this chapter. It was, and still is, the fulcrum of history. All the years before the events of which we read here in Luke chapter 2 were before Christ. Now, I don't want to go down a rabbit trail, but I would caution you that there are secularists, sometimes liberals, who want to refer to the division of years as BCE, before the common era, and CE, common era, so they don't have to refer the dates of the calendar to the birth of Christ. So I just want to warn you that if you ever come across those designations, you know that those are the inventions of wicked people. All the years before the events of which we read were before Christ, and all the years from those events onward are the years of the Lord, or the years of our Lord. So when you write the year, when you sit down to write a letter, if you still write letters, when you write the year, or when you write a check, or when you sign and date a formal document, you are demonstrating the reality that Jesus Christ came into the world. It was, in the words of the Apostle Paul, the fullness of the time. The ascension of Octavius Caesar to the place of authority and power in Rome, the one who came to be known as the Augustus, produced a period that marked the zenith of human accomplishment. No, they didn't launch anything into space. But under the administration of Caesar Augustus, the empire built a network of roads that are still the standard by which succeeding generations measure the endurance of their public works. Some of those roads are still in use today. The roads they built were for the efficient transportation of the imperial armies to the remotest parts of the empire's domain. And most of the time, those armies were moved on foot. Those roads were for the use of commerce, a network of commerce to bring many different commodities to the markets of the population centers of the empire. Caesar Augustus was a paragon of administration. He understood what needed to happen in order to preserve the peace in his dominion. And so effective was his administration that internal strife rarely arose. And in those rare occasions when it did, the emperor's legions were effective in crushing it. They didn't negotiate with the rebels, they simply destroyed them. Threats from those areas outside the empire's frontiers caused little concern because those same legions were adept at smashing such threats. To battle the Romans in their armies was to court almost certain defeat. We read in our text of those days. In those days, Caesar issued his decree. If you go back to chapter 1 and to verse 5, there's another reference to the days. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zechariah. We'll come to deal with that by and by. But it was in those days when Herod the Great was on the throne as the king of the Jews. In those days, there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus. So the timing of the decree, and here's the point I'm trying to get you to see, is part of the historical record. This is not a fairy story, not something that people made up. The name Caesar Augustus is well known in the historical record, and so is the decree. From the point when this decree went forth, Caesar began the practice which other civilizations have emulated of a periodic count or census of the inhabitants of the empire. In their case, it happened every 14 years. Now in the United States, next year, comes the constitutionally required decennial census. Every 10 years, there is to be a count made of all of the people in the country for the purpose of determining representation in the Congress and other factors as well. In Rome, they did it every 14 years. And if you go to AD 230, and you go backward by those intervals of 14 years, there are records of those periodic enrollments that Caesar Augustus instituted all the way back to AD 6. And that was a year in which the census caused a tremendous upheaval in the Jewish provinces. That would have been in the time when Jesus was a boy. 14 years before that date, was the first such decree. That was in 8 BC. As often happened, the emperor gave the various administrators of the empire flexibility in carrying out the decree. That is, he didn't insist that it be done that same year. In the Jewish provinces, resistance to Roman government sometimes flashed into the open. So they gave the administrators flexibility to decide when the best time would be. Now, we know that Herod the Great died in 4 BC. And since he died in that year, he must have published this decree of the emperor in either 6 or 5 BC. And that was the time when, as we learn in our text, Cyrenius was governor of Syria. Christ was born, we know, from Matthew's account, before the death of Herod. And so, therefore, was probably born during 5 BC. What about the apparent discrepancy? How could Christ be born before Christ? Well, the reason is that calendars were kept under a different formula in that time. And when the calendar that to which I have referred, BC and AD, when that calendar came into force, they had to recalculate events from the prior years, and that led to the idea that Christ was born in 5 BC. So here's a reference to the accomplishments of the great Caesar in those days. It was a time of peace. Historians writing about this era have adopted a Latin expression to describe that time. They call it Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Paul referred to it as the fullness of time. Let us turn to Galatians chapter 4. Galatians chapter 4. Verse 3, we read, "Even so we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. But when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons." But when the fullness of the time, that's a reference to those days. In those days, it was the very best that the world could produce. In that time, when the network was in place that would enable eventually the followers of Jesus to spread the gospel across the world, for the apostles used those roads to get from one place to another as missionaries of the cross. It was in that time that Jesus was born. It was God's judgment that not even the zenith of human civilization that the rule of Caesar Augustus represented was sufficient to satisfy God's requirements. Here was the best. But it was in those days that Jesus had to come. In those days, Caesar issued his decree. Now, those days refers also to the events of the preceding chapter. We already mentioned Luke chapter 1 and verse 5. But in that chapter, we find the announcements of two births. One was the birth of John the Baptist to Zacharias and Elizabeth. The other was the birth of Jesus to Mary, who was espoused to Joseph. So when those events, all unknown to the court of Caesar, when those events were unfolding in the purpose of God, Caesar issued his decree. The background of which we read here is that the decree of Caesar, not something that he intended, was the tool in the hands of God for getting everyone where needed to achieve the long-standing prophetic predictions. The words of verse 2 fix the time more precisely. This taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. Now the critics have had a field day with this verse. For a long time they complained that there was no such person as this Cyrenius, so here was clearly a mistake in Luke's account. But archaeological discoveries in recent years have uncovered the name of this man, and they have uncovered the name of this man in connection with his responsibilities under the Caesar as the governor of Syria at that very time. So God was pointing here to the exact moment in history for the accomplishment of that which he predicted all the way back to the aftermath of the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. In that crucial time, there came to the fore the assertion of human thinking. And that's the second point I want to make, Caesar's ambitious design. And with these other two points, we will not spend so much time. Centuries before the events of which we read here, King David took upon himself to make account of the people of his kingdom of Israel. So the scriptures say, just so that he could know how many there were. And before that time, there were counts made of the children of Israel, both right after they came out of Egypt and right before they went into the promised land. Caesar wanted to know how many people there were over which he ruled. And he wanted to know that number so he could calculate more efficient and greater amounts, no doubt, of revenue so as to ensure the consolidation and the continuation of the empire. And to this day, the purpose of government is always to ensure its own survival. Caesar had the idea of ensuring that in every province under his rule, the people would go back to their places of birth, their ancestral homes, to register themselves by their families. That was the most efficient means they could invent to accomplish this purpose. Now, it was for the satisfaction of Caesar's curiosity, to be sure, but it was for the promotion of his prestige as well, so that he could say, I am reigning over this number of people. It was the purpose of the government. But God was operating in those days, and he was bringing to pass his promises. And that's the third thing I leave with you today. Prophecy's exact fulfillment. The words of verse 3 provide a link for us between the policy of the government and the lives of those under the government's control. We've read about the decree, but in verse 3 we read, all went to be taxed. We can think of that as being counted in order to be taxed. Everyone into his own city. Now, in our next message in the series this evening, we're going to consider how this governmental decree affected people on the basic level. There were practical matters that had to occur for the prophecies of many years to come to pass. Chief among those prophecies was, first of all, that Jesus had to be born of the Virgin. And another chief prophecy was that he had to be born in Bethlehem of Judea, not where Joseph and Mary lived. The second of those prophecies was vivid in the minds of all the leaders of the Jews. If you turn back to Matthew chapter 2 and verse 4. Sometime after the birth of Jesus, the wise men came to Jerusalem seeking for Jesus. We read in verse 4 that when he, that is Herod the Great, had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. Herod the Great was not a student of the Hebrew Scriptures, even though he was the king of the Jews. And they said unto him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, and thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Now we're going to have occasion to look at that prophecy a little more in depth in our message this evening. But Mary and Joseph had to go to Bethlehem. Now, it was the purpose of the Caesar that they go to Bethlehem, because that was Joseph's ancestral home. The emperor had no inkling at all of their need to be in Bethlehem, but God was moving events so that they would be in Bethlehem, so that Jesus, the son of Mary, would be born in Bethlehem. So it was the decree of the government that compelled them to go there. The government had its own purpose, but God's purpose found its fulfillment in the governmental edict. And what is the message? Christ had to be born in Bethlehem. So the decree of Caesar Augustus, which he settled on as a mere expression of what he conceived to be good policy for efficient administration, that decree became in the hand of God the tool for getting Joseph and Mary from Nazareth to Bethlehem. We will talk about the hardships that were involved this evening. But the message is, God is always working to accomplish his purposes. In every decree of every government, he is accomplishing his purposes. And his ultimate purpose is the exaltation of his only begotten and well-beloved Son. The birth of Jesus Christ was the demonstration that God is not at any loss when it comes to bringing his purposes to fulfillment. And there is comfort there for you and for me in our lives. God is not at a loss for bringing his purposes concerning us to pass, to have us in the place where he has decreed that we should be. The purposes of the government and God were not aligned, but they did cross. And they crossed when God used Caesar's decree to send Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem of Judea so that there could be born in Bethlehem of Judea the Savior of all his people, the Lord Jesus Christ. May God then bless his word to our hearts and enable us in this reference to that which happened in history to understand that God is always at work in history to accomplish his purpose for the benefit of his people.